Welcome to the Punk Rock MBA Podcast.
What's up, everybody? I am Finn McKenty. This is the Punk Rock MBA Podcast. Today's guest is Lil Aaron, someone I've been wanting to have on the show for quite a while. As you might guess from his name, because it has a Lil in it, he is an emo rapper or alternative rapper or whatever word you want to use for it. But in addition to that, he's also a super talented songwriter, and we get into both of those things on this show. First of all, kind of the business model for being a solo artist and how a lot of alternative rappers such as himself embody that. And second, kind of a peek behind the scenes of how the whole songwriter thing works. He's worked with artists like Lizzo and Kim Petras and Black Bear, among many others, Selena Gomez, like real like A-list artists. And if you've ever wondered what it means when you see like seven songwriters on a song, or you know, when someone says they did a co-write, like what exactly does that mean and how do they get paid? How do you end up getting that job? Those are the kind of things that we talk about in this episode. So if that sounds interesting to you, then definitely stick around. Before we get into it, I wanted to mention a couple ways that you can support the show if you were so inclined. Number one, sharing it on social media really helps a lot because the podcast platforms don't do a whole lot there to help us get the word out about the show. Spotify is starting to do something there, but even then, it really helps a lot if you can share it and tag me, tag the guest, tag Deanna. Second, if you really, really like us, you can support us on Patreon. It is because of the patrons who support us, especially those of you who support at the true cult level or above, that we are able to do this show. That is the way that I was able to hire Deanna, our producer and editor, who makes this whole thing happen and is absolutely amazing. It is because of our patrons that we're able to do that. So thank you very much for your support. And if you are interested in supporting us over there, there's a link to that in the show notes. And with that out of the way, let's get into the show. Lil Aaron, welcome to the podcast, or as Zoom says, Aaron Lil. I like that. Like when you go to the DMV or something and right. they list your last name first. I like right. that.
Exactly. That's exactly what that is.
What if that I don't was know your that real happened. Name though? That would be so convenient.
Yeah. If my I come from a long lineage of Lils.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know how Zoom did that, and I don't know how to change it. I'm like very bad at Zoom. So.
Well, you know, Zoom unexpectedly got like 100 million new users because of the pandemic.
Yeah, they were in that list of companies that like definitely benefited off the pandemic.
Yeah, so I think that they probably got caught with a few rough edges that they planned to polish before this many people were on it. But
yeah,
they were like all the people zooming into like, you know, college classes with their dong out and whatnot.
Wow. Yeah, that would be unfortunate.
I guess there's a lot of things I wanted to talk about, you know, coming from Indiana to where you're at, among other things, and about just kind of how the songwriting process in your world works, because I think that's something a lot of people aren't aware of.
Yeah.
But first, let's talk about 808 Rock, your long-awaited EP that was supposed to come out a very long time ago that just came out, was it 2 weeks ago now?
Yeah, a week or two or three or four, I don't know.
Every day just blurs together now.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, so first off, I don't know that it was necessarily like supposed to come out forever ago, but it has been done for a while. I kind of purposefully sat on it for a minute because I was waiting for the right time to drop it. I mean, when me and Eric Ron started that project like 3 years ago, if we dropped it that year, I don't think it would have been.
Oh, wow. It's that old.
Proper timing. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's when we
started doing the first couple songs. But I think even still, I was a little early on it, but good early. Like, I think if that would have dropped like summer of 2021, it would have been like, boom. But I also enjoy being early to the party. I just didn't want to be 3 years early to the party.
Right. Well, 3 years ago, if you put this out, that would have been so early that nobody would get it at all.
Well, the whole idea of guitars and trap hats hadn't even affected mainstream in the way that it has now at that point. So
I mean, I would say even people like in the underground wouldn't have gotten it 3 years ago.
Yeah, but people in the underground didn't get the projects I was dropping 3 years ago either. I wouldn't say I'm massively embraced by the underground. Like I definitely have my subset of the underground that fucks with me, but like I'm definitely like a little bit more polished than a lot more of the underground stuff, and then yes, a little bit rougher around the edges than a lot more of the mainstream stuff. So it's kind of one of those like caught in the middle type things.
So how do you know when the right time to release something is? Like, what made you think
there's no way to like know for sure? I kind of just I mean, I had already planned on dropping it, you know, at the near the second half of this year, before the MGK rollout happened. But that was definitely a good sign to me.
People
were opening up to like rock music with rap influence and shit like that. So that definitely put some like, you know, that definitely helped me pull the trigger. Also just in general, you know, I really feel the resurgence of nu metal starting to happen, you know,
with
bands like Omerta and like Vain, and like, you know, there's a lot of cool shit happening where I'm like, all right, like the cool kids are starting to understand that this is the next shit. So like, now let me like put my timestamp on this, even though, like, you know, I dropped Vans Untied at the beginning of the year, and I think that properly timestamped, like, hey guys, this I'm doing this, you know. But the project as a whole and the 808 Rock music video kind of like just like secured where it was. Any artist could come out with the crazy trap nu metal comeback, and then if I came out a week or two later, it's all of a sudden like derivative of that, even though it'd been done 3 years earlier. So it's kind of a delicate balance of like figuring out when to pull the trigger and not waiting too long, but not rushing it. But I think it was perfect timing for setting me up for like the album that I'm currently working on.
Is that going to be another 3 years, or hopefully not that long?
No, I promise it won't be. I mean, fuck, the way I work, maybe, but I've already got like a couple songs that I think will make it. I also like have been, my whole career, I've been like so scared of the idea of an album, because I never want to give people more than what they want, you know? But the fact that people were upset that 808 Rock wasn't an album is like the best complaint I think you can get from your fans. Like, what the fuck? You're not giving us enough, you know? So I'm like, perfect. So it basically, as soon as I announced the EP, like before it was even out and people were complaining about how short it was, I already was like, perfect. I can start working on an album. Like, people actually want to hear an album from me, which is crazy, you know? Because when you come out the gate, you're like, will you listen to 30 seconds of one song, please? You know?
Right.
And then like you get a couple songs, and you're like, would you possibly listen to a 3 or 4 song EP? And then it's good to know that now I'm at the point where I'm like, fuck it. If I put out like an 18 song album, my fans are going to be excited that there's that much content.
Well, that's a good time for me to kind of back up a little bit. You've been making music for a long time, but you came from Indiana. When did you move from Indiana? And you're from Goshen, which I've been
like
to
like 7 years ago, I think. Yeah. Goshen kind of sucks. I mean, look, there's obviously the cool aspects of it and the sucky aspects of it, but it's not built for someone like me.
What made you think, and I don't mean this in like a shitty way, but like, what made you think you could do this? Like a dude from Goshen coming out here to do what you do.
Recently I've been trying to do a lot of like reflecting on stuff like that. Cause you know, now that I'm like, I'm 26 and like, I'm kind of reaching this point in my life of like, I achieved a lot of things that I worked towards, but like, I'm still like trying to assess and look around and see what the next moves are. But it's like some of that like blind ignorance I had when I was like 16 to like 20, or where I just like fully believed I was like the best ever. And the funniest thing is that like the art that I was making at that point is like the worst shit ever. You know, I hadn't done anything to warrant like the fact that I really thought I was the one that was going to make it out, or the one that, you know, could take it to the next step or whatever. Some of it I wish I could have back, you know, that like just blind, like I'm the shit. Everything I do is the best thing ever. And like one day I'm going to be rich and famous, you know? And now I'm kind of like, all right, like I'm pretty cool. And like, sometimes I do some cool shit. And like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
I don't know. I don't know what that spark was when I was younger that like fucking made me go against every logical thought and think that I would be the one that would come out of my town, that would make it to LA, that would, you know, get to where I'm at now. I don't know what that was. I wish I could put my finger on it.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like, I think back to, you know, when I was younger, I never like second guessed myself. I was just like, oh, I'm going to do this thing. And not that I necessarily thought it was going to be the best thing ever, or that I was going to end up, you know, rich and famous, but I didn't worry about whether people were going to like it or if it was going to be popular.
Yeah, I think also it's like you have a lot less to lose. You have nothing to lose, you know, when you're like a young kid. It's just like, fuck it, I'll move to LA and I'll roll the dice with this. What's the worst that could happen? I end up back in my shitty town or whatever. And then as you move on, I mean, not that like, you know, not that I'm like over here second guessing every move now, but it's it there definitely isn't that same just like blind like I'll just go into any situation and I'll fucking, you know, like it's gonna work out for me. Now I'm like I kind of assess situations like maybe yeah. I should hold off on this one, but it's the best decision I ever made in my life, you know, moving to LA. I moved to LA with like $400 cash. I like
you're rich.
I slept on a futon from Target, you know, it's just stupid shit. Like, I think I was just so hungry for anything else, you know, in like middle school and high school, I hated everything, you know, saying it wasn't, you know, classic, like kid listening to fucking Warped Tour emo music. But like, I really did. I was just like, this fucking town isn't for me. Like, I'm not built for this shit. I'm built for something bigger. Before I moved to LA, I was on the road for a couple years with a couple different bands, and like I knew that I wanted to like get out. And then I think through that, we toured through LA a couple times, and every time I was here, I was like, whoa, like this is it. This is where you become a star. This is where you get to fucking roll the dice, you know? And I think, you know, me and my friends kind of refer to like being in LA as like a glitch in the matrix, because like you can be out here and then like randomly like crazy shit opportunities just happen, you know, like when you can just place yourself in LA, the situations and people that you'll run into is just like, it's insane. Like I think that was part of it too. It was just like you run, like I don't know, I knew that nothing was happening where I was at, and I knew that I don't think LA turned out to be exactly what I thought it was, but you know, I saw LA as this place where like, look, if I'm gonna do it, I have to go here.
What are some of the ways that it's not what you thought?
It can also be a shithole, and there's a bunch of shitty people, and it's like mostly built on lies, you know, like it's like,
yeah, this, yeah, we'll
it's
do like
the
city together.
Of broken dreams, right? You know, it's like every Uber driver and waiter you have thought that they were that kid that would make it out of their hometown and be rich and famous too. And it gets like kind of dark. I mean, look, I applaud anyone that even fucking steps up to the bat to swing. What happens after that, good or bad, like who cares? Like the fact that anyone would like come to LA and roll the dice and put everything on the line just to like make a crazy dream a plausible reality, you know, like the possibility of it coming true. Like I applaud anyone who tries, anybody who puts themselves out there. You don't even have to come to LA, just like anybody who uploads a song to SoundCloud, like fucking put yourself out there. It's gonna suck
and that's
first.
Okay, that's part of the process.
I remember, so my older brother's in bands and stuff, and that's like kind of how I first got introduced to like the live music scene and all that. One of my first bands was about to play some shows, and I'd never played a show, and I was so fucking nervous. And I was talking to the bassist in my brother's band, and I was just like, man, like I'm so fucking nervous. What am I going to do? And he's like, dude, the first like 10, 20 shows are going to suck. You're not going to do good. Just get them out of the way. So then I remember I just booked like 20 shows in like 2 months, you know. I'm like, all right, if these are gonna suck, I'm gonna get them out of the way so I can start getting good. I obviously didn't get good. I don't even think I got good at live performing until the tour that I saw that we met on, you
the
know?
Issues
like,
one.
Yeah, that's like not even live performance has always been I don't want to say my weakest point, but I think where I have the most area for growth. Same thing applies to coming to LA, where I was just like, it's gonna suck, so just do it and get it out of the way.
I just think of it like a deck of cards. Like the bottom of the deck is the good stuff. And so you just got to get through all the shitty cards first.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. 100%. And again, like I think back then I had nothing but time on my hands, right? So like for me to back then be like, okay, maybe if I put like 2 years into this, maybe something will happen, you know? I had all the fucking time in the world. Oh, dedicate 2 years to this, or like be doing some bullshit in LA, interning or whatever for a year. Like that didn't sound that crazy, you know? And look back at this year, like fucking, it's crazy how quick a year can go by. But
has this been a good year for you? Because a lot of people I've talked to said this is like one of their best years.
Mental health, probably not my best ever, but yeah. Financially, definitely one of my best years. My structure of how I get paid isn't really built on like if I do anything. It's more of the accumulation of what I've done in the past. So like it doesn't really matter how good a year is. I think every year is going to grow
hopefully
for me.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that for a minute. So you are in it, you know, most people listening to this probably know you for your own music, but you do a lot of songwriting and production for other people too. I know some of that stuff, but can you kind of tell people what you've done there? And I want to talk a little bit about how that
works. I hate this question because I honestly like don't have like a list, but I mean, like, I think some of the most notable stuff I've done is working on the Lizzo "'Cause I Love You" album, that won a Grammy this year. I did a song for Big Boy. That's his biggest song since being an Outkast. I've done like so many songs with Black Bear, probably like more than 10.
And when you say doing a song, what does that mean?
You know, created a song together. Like I, in all those examples, my credit would be as a songwriter. All of my biggest, you know, music accolades are as a songwriter. I didn't even really start getting into the production thing until like the last year and a half. And for the first year of that, I was mostly just doing it alone on my computer. So I have a couple cool production things coming soon, but none of the like things that I've accomplished in my past thus far have been like the biggest ones haven't been songwriting.
I'm going to ask some dumb questions here because there's a lot of stuff here that I think people don't understand. So when you say you wrote a song with Black Bear, does that mean you wrote every word coming out of his mouth or of the song that people hear on Spotify, or what exactly does that mean?
Okay. Yeah. That's a question I get a lot. The hardest thing for people to wrap their heads around is that it is literally different every single time. There's no blanket answer. So someone like Black Bear is he's fucking amazing,
fucking good songwriter.
Amazing songwriter. It's not like he needs me to like, he's going to make a great, you know what I'm saying? He's going to make a great song without me. But what the way that we work together is that we bounce stuff back and forth. So a lot of the stuff would be like, we were on tour together. So like we were just circumstantially around each other all the time. And so like to blow off steam or to like get away from the crowd or whatever, we would go to a little studio on the back of the bus and write stuff. So it's like, it's not like either of us needed, you know what I'm saying? People think that like, just cause you collaborated with someone that one of you needed each other. And but like,
it's like, Aaron's really writing everything for him.
No, that at all. And it's like the other way around too. It's like, if I work with someone that like, I needed that. It's like
Eric Ron does everything.
Yeah, exactly. Even though, like, man, he really does do everything. Eric is the GOAT.
Yeah, but people, it's just weird. Like how people always want to discredit.
Dude, I've seen people like complaining about the amount of songwriters on the MGK album, and it's like, yo, like, who fucking cares? Like, how many people worked on a piece? Like, if there was a painting and like 30 people painted on it, like, why does that make the painting less cool?
Do you like the painting or not?
Yeah, exactly. I don't give a fuck. It makes it cooler to me. And at the same time, I think that just goes to show that, like, I think you should credit everyone that works on your project, because a lot of these projects that you see that only have 4 people credited on them, they're not crediting everybody that fucking steps in the room and works on it. And then it looks like so cool to you because, they wrote and produced it and whatever. It's like, just because they didn't credit everyone does not make it cooler or them a better artist, in my opinion.
And, you know, if it's some, with all due respect to them, if it's some small, like, if it's an MGK record and I worked on it, you better fucking believe I'm going to fight to get a credit on there.
Exactly. But if it's
some random local small, I'm like, whatever. You can credit me or not. I don't care.
Exactly. It doesn't fucking make or break your day. Yeah. As a songwriter who exists off credit, you know, and credit gets me future jobs, but it's the percentage that actually pays my bills. But I'm not going to go into the specific of the song, but there's a song that I'm dealing with right now, multiple songs on an album that I worked on that I wasn't credited on or have been, you know, worked out any percentage. So it's like, it's frustrating as a songwriter where it's like, there's not as much tangible evidence that I did something, where if you invite me into a room and we bounce ideas off of each other and then you record it, like, it's hard for me without your blessing or you saying that I did it to be like, no, I did that. Like, you know, it's kind of built on some version of an honor system, you know? So
when you're working on a song, that could be anything from you just giving them some suggestions on arrangement, like maybe you should repeat this chorus a couple more times, or it could be you writing lyrics and melody, or it could be like,
a lot of times it's like, it's lyrical, conceptual. That's kind of my bag, is like conceptual, lyrical. I think melodically too, I have a lot of really good ideas, but if I'm working with someone like Bear, it's like, we're kind of just keeping the momentum going. So if he like comes up with a line, I'll just like,
it seems like he's feed really him ideas good for the next melodies. Line.
Oh yeah. He's amazing with melodies. Yeah. That's how some of the artists that I'm like closer with as friends, I think the way we usually work is like, you know, there's a beat or something, you know, the music that we're writing to. And then we kind of just keep the momentum going, just throwing ideas back and forth, like sing a little hook idea, sing it back. Maybe one person will tweak that idea. And then it kind of just morphs into something. And then, like, you know what I'm saying? The beat's just going and you're just throwing it back and forth until it grows and it grows and it grows and becomes a hook. And then it becomes a verse and a hook.
And you're not really worried about, like, oh, did Aaron write?
No, and no fucking good songs are built like that. That's the problem, is that, like, it has to be kind of, it has to be this honor system where, like, after the song is made, we just, you know, in the pop music world, it's kind of assumed that it's like, if we go into a room to make a session, everybody's leaving with equal credit, you know? And I prefer it like that, because I don't want these, like, fucking email threads of, like, fighting over 2% or 5%. It's like, anytime someone's like, and it's like, okay, you want an extra 2%, whatever, take it. I don't give a fuck, man. Like, I'm not going to sit here and try to remind you what I did in the room, because we were both probably high and we just were throwing ideas back and forth.
Like, I programmed twice as many hi-hats as you did.
Yeah, dude, that shit's so, like, I don't even know. It's like, okay, if you really think you're doing more than me, then maybe we just shouldn't be working together. I only really want to work with people that kind of can all agree that we're all equals in the room. And even if someone does carry the weight that day, like, the next time we work together, I'm probably going to carry the weight, you know?
So how do you end up working on a, like, top level artist like Lizzo that is, as far as I know, she's not really part of, like, your social circle. How do you end up being part of a project like that?
When I worked with Lizzo, she was, like, not near as popular as she is now. So I think, you know, timing was a big thing with that. I would attribute some of that to luck. I was doing a lot of different sessions, but Ricky Reed brought me into that, and he signed and developed her. So
you know him from some other project?
You know, just being around in the scene, yeah. Around. I had a couple friends that were signed to him, and through that I got to meet him, and I was a fan of his. So I, you know, when we initially met, I think I kind of just expressed, like, hey man, I've been a big fan of your stuff since Wallpaper. So we found.
So if you meet somebody, it's not a bad move to tell them that you like. It's like people want to, like, be cool and, like, not tell somebody that you like their shit.
That's the most annoying thing, especially with, like, this younger. Look, I'm not saying this is a specifically happens with the younger generation. I'm sure it happens every shift of, you know, people, but, like, when I meet someone, I'm sorry. I can tell if you've heard my music. I can listen to I can put your song on and be like, all right, you've heard Drugs before. Like, you know what I'm saying? And I can tell when people are like, oh, what's your name? I'm like, and then, like, you know, like 30 minutes later, like, oh, you're Lil Aaron. I'm like, bro, there's no one else out here that looks like me and dresses like me. Like, if you know who Lil Aaron is, you knew who I was as soon as I walked in the room. But it's
see what
fine.
I like to do. The power move is deliberately get someone's name wrong. Like, I would keep calling you Eric.
Yeah, there we go. Big Eric.
Yeah, and I'd be like, oh, yeah, no, Aaron. Okay, yeah, no, I'll remember that. That's what I like to do, just so everyone knows I'm important.
And yeah, you're just like, wait, so you always wear green?
Yeah. That's cool, man. Yeah, no, I like the green thing.
I like the green. You should stick to that. I think you could pay off.
Right.
But it's just funny when I meet like an artist, I guess it doesn't have to be younger than me, but, you know, I love all of the new SoundCloud shit. But, like, when a kid is just like, oh, you're a Lil Aaron. I'm like, bro. You knew right. But it's okay. I was there too. We were all there. Like, I remember being nervous around meeting people. And
I remember, like, meeting bands that I liked when I was, like, a kid and almost, like, being rude to them because I thought it was, like, going to make me seem cooler or something.
Yeah. Yeah. That's,
and
like the hot girl
just
thing.
What the fuck is wrong with that kid?
Like, when hot girls are mean to you, it's like, that doesn't work when you're, like, a fucking band dude.
Right. 18-year-old nerd.
Yeah. When you're fucking, like, yeah, they're just going to be like, all right, well, fuck you. Bye.
Right. Like, I don't know why I did that.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series.
About how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with.
The way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments. The ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember. The ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app.
And subscribe now.
Welcome to us talking about our podcast for a minute.
What's the name of that podcast?
That's Axe to Grind. And right now you're going to be getting a little taste of it, right down to the shaky microphone and all.
And my name's Bob.
And my name's Patrick. And usually we're joined by Tom.
Tom's the best. Tom has a real grown-up job that requires him to be at work. But we talk about decidedly not so grown-up things like
hardcore music and things that people that like hardcore music tend to like.
So that could be the latest shows, revisiting classic material, talking about the new classics, all the little dorm room nonsense that you imagine from niche music podcasts that you either love, want to love, or hate.
Yeah, imagine all the emotions that you have towards a genre that has impacted your life. And then condense them down to an hour to 2 hours a week.
So triangulate your speakers. Think about jumping off the bed, singing along, dancing like an idiot, and listen to Axe to Grind podcast.
But first, I want to thank DistroKid for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. If you're not familiar, DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that musicians use to put their music into online stores and streaming services. So in plain language, if you have ever wondered how to get your music on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Deezer, Tidal, and many, many more, there's like dozens and dozens of different streaming services, DistroKid is the way to do it. It is super easy. I have used it to put my music on Spotify. It took me maybe 5 minutes to like set it up and upload everything. It's legitimately awesome. I am sincerely a fan of this company and their product. And for those of you who have asked, you can also upload your music to TikTok with DistroKid. And if you want a chance to get featured on DistroKid's Spotify playlists, you can do that by submitting a song through Spotlight and getting your fans to vote for you. You can also use Hyperfollow to get more Spotify followers. You can promote your new release as well as Spotify Canvas. That's where there's the video in the background in the player. And when you share it on Instagram, it shares that video too to make your Spotify release pop. And Spotify Canvas is available to all DistroKid artists. Like I said, as you can probably tell from this, like I am sincerely a fan of DistroKid. DistroKid can do everything I just talked about and so much more. So be sure to sign up with my link, which is in the show notes for this episode, to get 7% off your first year. That link is in the show notes of this episode, or go to distrokid.com/VIP/thepunkrockNBA. And thanks again to DistroKid for sponsoring this episode.
But okay, so you had mentioned that you get paid based on, you know, sort of the accumulation of stuff that you've done. So I think I understand what you mean by that, but explain that in regards to like your work as a writer.
So yeah, so like every song I work on that comes out, there's a percentage of the songwriting side of the song that I get, right? So that's what I'm paid out. Songwriters are pretty much paid last in the train of payouts, you know, especially in the major label system. We're like the last people to receive anything. But so if I work on a song, I get a percentage of it. It's essentially added to my catalog that I have a co-publishing deal with a company that helps me collect, right? So the bigger that my catalog gets by just adding songs to it, even small songs, big songs, medium songs, all of them build this catalog to a thing that generates revenue every, you know what I'm saying? It's basically this cloud of intellectual property ownership that is monetized through streaming and other outlets that as long as that gets bigger, and all the songs in it don't fizzle out and become like songs that no one listens to. Yeah. Like it just grows every month. And
it's passive income. You don't have to do anything.
Exactly. It's passive income. And so, yeah, it's kind of a cool place to be. I mean, if the pandemic would have happened like 5 or 6 years ago, I would have been super fucked. You know, I was like living couch to couch, you know, like who the fuck would have let me stay on their couch during fucking COVID? Like, but the fact that it happened in 2020, which, you know, in one way, it's like, this was about to be my biggest year. I started off this year with the Selena Gomez cut and like the Grammy thing and like all this shit. It was like, boom. And then like everything gets cut short. But at the same time, I built my business up to a point where whether or not I'm working, I'm still generating revenue. So I'm at a place now where, you know, I could take some time off to really focus on production and start getting into some of the nerd shit that I like hadn't got time to like really focus on. And, you know, I went home for a bit and saw my family. It's like little things that I'm super grateful that I'm at a place where like I can afford to do that. And that's not to like rub it in anyone's face.
No, obviously.
Like my heart goes out to anyone who the pandemic's affected like that. But
the reason I mentioned that is not to rub it in anyone's face, but because I want people listening to this to go, oh, that sounds pretty cool. How can I create my own opportunities for passive income like that? Whether that's songwriting or, you know, owning fucking gumball machines. I don't know.
I think what's really cool, even if you take songwriting out of it, with streaming these days, you know, obviously everybody's up in arm about streaming payout, and I think they should pay us more anyway. But I'm not gonna like fucking die on that hill. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I think that if you're an independent artist and you have the ability to write and produce and record your own material, fucking drop everything on Spotify. Like drop a song all the time, like an EP here and there. Because what happens is that same thing that I'm describing with my catalog of songwriting stuff can happen with your DistroKid or your TuneBaby account, where like all of a sudden every month it's just paying you out. And every time you drop a new project, like I drop 808 Rock and all the streams on my old EPs go up, you know? So it's like just build that thing of passive income. It's intellectual property. It's like fucking music that you own the master of. And even if you don't own the master, you can still get paid out on it. But
how many people do you know who are relatively small underground artists that are making a living off of streams?
Everyone that I know, I feel like.
So 10, 20, 30 people.
I think more than that.
A lot of people. I know a handful, and I'm sure you know 10 times more than I do.
I think every I would say everyone that I came up with, I think, you know, like in the last 4 or 5 years, if they're not signed to a major label, they're like independently living off of the money that their music generates. And I'm not, that doesn't mean that everyone's fucking rich, but like, yo, if you're out in LA and your Spotify is getting you $5,000-$6,000 a month, and then on top of that, you can be doing a couple other little things to get some more money. It's like, you can live off that. It's not, you know what I'm saying? You can make that shit work.
Yeah. I doubt Fatsy is.
And you don't have to fucking be in LA. Like, that's one of the things that I in my mind thought I had to be in LA, but like, there's people that are killing it on Spotify and then live in fucking Oklahoma and pay $600 on rent. So it's
sure, like Johnny Frank, Bill Murray, he lives in Columbus.
Yeah. Yeah. Oliver Francis lives in St. Louis. I tried to get him to come out to LA, and he's been out here, but he was like, dude, it's so much easier to live out there. I'm like, I don't blame you. I wish that I had the infrastructure to be able to do that. I don't, you know what I'm saying? Like, but the fact that they can do that is awesome. If your overhead is lower, fucking run it.
I think about it sometimes. You know, we live in Seattle, which is about the same as LA as far as like cost of living. And sometimes I'm like, man, are we stupid for living here instead of like moving to fucking Kansas City or something? And then I'm like, yeah, but it's Kansas City. And
exactly.
You
know,
God bless the people who enjoy, like, I didn't grow up there. So I think that's a big part of it. But
yeah,
you know, I lived in Ohio for 12 years or whatever. And
I lived in Ohio for a couple of years.
I didn't enjoy it. God bless the people who like it there, but it's not for me.
I love Ohio, but I don't know. Yeah, I feel you. I feel you. I at this point, I'm like, I don't think I can live anywhere else but LA.
Well, but my point with all of that is exactly what you said. Is like, I want anybody listening to this to realize that they can create this passive income from anywhere in the world. And you might think that it's a liability that you don't live in LA. And you know, there's certain advantages to living in a cool city, but you also have a cost advantage if you live somewhere that's not quote unquote cool, because you're paying $600 a month.
With Zoom and all this shit, like, I haven't done them personally, but I know a lot of people that are doing writing and production sessions over Zoom these days.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, you can kind of do it wherever. I think also, like, you don't need to have a publishing deal or a manager or or have to, you know, be the artist and the producer. Like, if you're a producer and you make beats, find an artist and make a whole project with them and split everything 50-50. You know what I'm saying? Put it out on Spotify and push it to all of your networks and split the money 50-50. You can still see a decent amount of money off of doing that. Like, if you're just a vocalist, start a group with somebody. Start a group with someone who produces and someone who, oh, you sing, find someone who raps, and like, start a group and then put stuff on fucking DistroKid and split it three ways. Like, there's, I'm not saying that you should get into underground music for the payout, but like, right, there is money going around. And if you build a fan base and you build, you know, a cult following over the course of like a couple years, like, you could really start seeing that pay your bills.
Yeah. And, you know, like you said, you know, tons of people who have done exactly that. How do you kind of balance all of the writing and production kind of stuff versus your own music? Like, is there one that's more of a priority for you than the other, or how do you think about that?
It kind of ebbs and flows, but I've always kind of described it, up until this year, I always kind of described it as, time-wise, I would spend 80% of my time as a songwriter and 20% of my time as an artist. Just when it comes to like time dedication to creating music, I think as far as like persona on the internet, I'm 100% artist. Right. But before COVID, I was like, if I wasn't on tour, I was in the studio every single day working on other people's projects. You know, that's my, like, I don't want to call it a day job, but like, that would be the equivalent of my day job. That's like what I wake up and that's what my plan is to do with my day, is to go to the studio to work with X artist and work on a song for their project. That, I think, was just a natural progression of me kind of following the bag, you know.
Yeah.
I kind of saw that was generating more income and I enjoyed doing it just as much, you know.
If do you not, feel like if, they kind of like feed each other, like you learn things from one that you apply to the other?
Definitely. I sometimes I do wonder, you know, where my artist career would be if I had spent all of the last 5 years of just focusing on that and not, you know, splitting my time between being a songwriter and an artist. But at the same time, it's like the connections I have,
yeah,
me having songs with Black Bear is attributed to me also working with them on the songwriting front. And then me having songs with Kiara or Kim Petras all kind of revolves back to being a songwriter and meeting them in that way. So like, I think being a songwriter only helps my artist career. Time-wise, you know, I think maybe some of my projects haven't been as long because I, instead of spending 4 months on just that, I'm spending like a week every month on that. But that's kind of like what I'm trying to do going forward with this new project is actually dedicate, for once since Glowing Pains, really, dedicate like a period of time to just doing that instead of just like, oh, doing it when I have free time, you know, instead of just being like, oh, I got home from the studio working with someone else, let me finish this record for my project, like actually making the main focus of the day my project, which is weird to even think about because it's like, okay, now I have, I don't know, you know what I'm saying?
But it's great that you have the option of, you know, it's, you're going to be making music either way. It's just sort of like you now have the choice of where you want to focus that energy, which is an awesome place to be.
Yeah. Well, and to be honest, like if I write a really great song for someone else, as soon as I leave the studio, like the burden of fucking promoting that song and doing a radio tour and touring off that song is now on them. I just fucking make money off of it, which is sick, you know? But at the same time, it's like, oh, if that song goes number one, their name is on the number one song, not me. And who the fuck really looks at the credits, you know? So like, there's best of both worlds. You know what I'm saying? Both sides of the token where it's like, it's dope that I can like go, I can make money off of like 3 or 4 hours of work. You know what I'm saying? Realistically, like a song, like, you know, a lot of the songs I've worked on is like between 1 hour and like 7 hours of work. Right. And then I'm kind of out and then they are pushing the ball uphill the rest of the way. And I just get to get paid on it. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, there are songs that like I guess the question I get a lot too is like, oh, how do you know if it's your song or their song? There's a song, I'm not going to say exactly which one it was, but there is a song that I sent to an artist that was going to be me featuring them. And then they ended up asking if they could be them featuring me. And I was like, sure. And then now that song has like tens and tens and tens of millions of views. So it's like, I'm like, I kind of think like, oh man, I should have made that my song. But then it's like, if I didn't have their team pushing it, like who right. knows that it actually would have reached that same potential. And my name's still on it. Like I'm not salty by any means, but it does happen sometimes where it's like, oh, I was thinking about this being for me, but if you really want it to be for you, like, sure. That's kind yeah. of how I treat a lot of my music is if I played it for someone and they're a friend of mine and I'm passionate about their project and I know that them and their team are going to push it, if they really want a song, like, I bet. There's a couple songs that I hold very dearly that I'm like, that I've been, you know, accumulating that I think will eventually come out in a way, hopefully on this album, if I can fit them in the right way. But there's a couple songs that I'm like, oh, this is my fucking song no matter what. But a lot of times it's like, okay, it's a great song. And if I think this artist sells it and like really wants to buy into it and take it to the finish line, I'm cool with that. I can write another one. That's the thing is like, I can do it again.
Well, it sounds like you kind of have an attitude in general of like, you know, it's not that you are indifferent or anything, but it seems like you just kind of go with the flow in a lot of ways.
I think that's probably the best way to describe it. Whatever feels right at the time, you know? I'm not going to give like a crazy record that I think is amazing to someone that like that when they cut the demo, it doesn't sound good. But like if you kill it and you want to make it your song and you're going to put all your resources behind it, fuck it, you know?
The reason I bring that up is because I think a lot of people maybe have like control issues and they think that if they try to control everything in their career, that's going to help. And I'm not sure that it does. Like you could get all bent out of shape about exactly the way you want this session to go tomorrow, but you don't know right. if it's going to go that way. And you being pushy and telling the artist that you want to work your way and that you get, you know, is very likely to actually make that artist have a bad experience, especially when they're trying to make it have a very I guess I would say control issues. Like they feel like the right. the way is to like clamp down and like, no, when you come to the studio, you got to do things my way. We've got to do it exactly like this. And then they get pissed off if it's not their way. And they might be right. But at the end of the day, if that means the artist has a bad experience, then it's like, right. well, the guy's a good songwriter, but what a fucking pain in the ass to work with, and the manager doesn't like you. And you know, I just, my experience in life has been that like I always have a vision of how I want things to go, but I don't expect that it is going to go that way.
My whole life has just kind of been like just kind of throw myself into a situation and then figure out the best possible outcome, you know what I'm saying? Like I don't think I'm 100% guilty of overthinking. Like I have crazy anxiety, but like, I don't think like over planning things is something that ever benefits anyone. It's really you're helped. Setting yourself yeah. and everyone else up for letdown, you know? So kind of just like I set up each day just trying to have fun and make something dope.
I want to also make sure that I take this opportunity to get some, if you can, I don't know, some people is kind of intuitive, to get some actual songwriting tips for people, because that's the thing that I feel very strongly about, especially like in the rock and metal world. I feel like it sounds weird to say, but I feel like songwriting is almost like an afterthought, you know?
Yeah, I've started to learn about that. Yeah, the way that songwriting is treated in the rock world is really weird, but I mean, it's obviously worked for them,
but
I don't know. I'm not going to come here and say they're doing anything wrong.
I'll be the asshole.
I think also there's this weird like stigma around having people. I mean, like, okay, especially if you want to talk about something being punk, you know, it's like,
yeah.
Oh, it's so not, I think that's part of why people are up in arms about the MGK thing. Like, oh, it's not punk to like have songwriters. It's like, is it, man? Is it not punk for like a bunch of people to be hanging out and making a fun song
that are probably friends?
Yeah. And for each of them to, and for each of them to get credit, is that not punk? It's like, shut the fuck up, man. Yeah. It's so stupid. I think there's this weird like idea that if you make art by yourself, it's cooler, which like is just not true or right or fucking.
It's just like a weird like assumption. Like, what?
Well, it's also that breeds a culture where people actively try to avoid crediting other people so that it looks cooler that they did it by themselves, which doesn't fucking matter. It does not matter, and it's not cool. Like, it all it does is put pressure on people to downgrade other people's attributions, which isn't punk to me.
Right. That's a good point. You know? But let's say somebody has a solo project and they are just writing stuff by themselves at home, and they're in like a metal band or rock band or whatever. What advice would, and maybe they're just realizing now, like, oh, I never really took songwriting seriously as like a craft. What advice would you have for that person?
Write 3 songs a day for like as long as you can.
And what if they all suck?
They will suck. There's no way that you can like do that quantity of something without it all sucking. So like, but it's just the practice of doing it, you know, the practice of, you know, okay, like hooks are easy, but when I get to the second verse, it's really hard. Fucking do it. Just do it and do it 3 times a day, every day. And then eventually you'll find out that like getting to the second verse isn't that hard anymore because you've started to develop these tools that creatively help you get from point A to point B. So, oh, okay. Well, when I get to the second verse, it's always really hard to come up with something, but I know that like, if I just say the opposite, if I start by saying the opposite mm-hmm. of what I said in the first verse, I have a jump off point. Okay, I can use the same melody here, but like adapt it a little bit. You start figuring out this, it's like
a playbook
or a Swiss Army knife of just like different things you can do. And you can apply that to anything in your life. But I think when I decided that I wanted to do songwriting, I hadn't really spent time as a songwriter. I'd written songs for my projects, but I hadn't like done anything as a songwriter. I was like, all right, fuck it. It's the same thing I was telling you about the show. The first 100 are gonna suck. And honestly, the first 1,000 probably sucked, but I did them and I got them out of the way. And then along the way, if you write 1,000 songs, one of them is going to be fucking cool. All right. One of them is going to be okay. And then you latch onto that and fucking maybe put that one out or don't, or just keep going. Like for a while, I was scared to release music because I was like, oh man, everything I make 6 months from now is way cooler. So like, why would I ever put this out? Because I'm going to be better in 6 months, in 3 months, whatever it is. But then it's like, okay, well, that's going to happen the rest of my life. So like, what am I going to do? Just sit here and wait for like only going to drop my magnum opus after not dropping songs right. for 12 years.
You're like 80.
Exactly. But which kind of would be sick. But at the same time, it's like, just get that shit out there, man. Like I think doing things for sport almost.
Getting in the reps,
it helps you get better. That's like obvious. I think anyone would tell you that about anything in life. If you want to get better at something, like do it a lot. And do it when you don't want to do it. Do it early in the morning when you don't want to. Do it late at night when you don't want to. Do it when it sucks and not when it's convenient. And then you're gonna get good at it.
I think a lot of people wait until they're inspired, which doesn't happen very often.
People wait too much. It's like the perfect opportunity for anything isn't going to happen until you make it happen. I talk to so many people like, you know, like when I go home and like it's like the night before Thanksgiving and everyone's at the bars. It's like, oh, man, like how'd you like, you know, move into L.A., blah, blah, blah. Like how'd you do it? I've been like, you know, like one of these days I'm going to like you're already too far past it. If you're thinking about, oh, it's one of these days in the future, like you just got to do it. Like literally, whether it's moving to L.A., whether it's dropping a song, whether it's, oh, hey, I want to be a songwriter. Just fucking do it. The thing that I did when I decided I was a songwriter is I made my social media wasn't even like anywhere as big as it is now. I probably had like 500 or 600 followers, but I put like my bio on everything was the greatest songwriter in the world. Uh-huh. And I just fucking would say it. I just said it. I said it a bunch of times. Like, and I know this is some like kooky manifestation shit, but at the same time, it made other people when they met me, because I'd said it so many times, they're like, oh, you're a songwriter. They hadn't heard anything I wrote, and I hadn't played them anything that would lead them to believe I was good or bad, but I had said that I'm the best songwriter. So they came in with the expectation that I was a good songwriter. Like just fucking do it and say that's what you do. Like,
I think that is like such an important thing. It's like, call yourself the thing you want to be, because imagine like I met you at a party and you introduced yourself as like, oh, well, right now I work at a record store, but you know, I also like, you know, I have my own music and sometimes I'm a songwriter and you know, one of these days I might put out a video. Like, then I'm like, all right, so you're a guy that works at a record store.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Versus if you had the exact same life, but you told me I'm a songwriter.
Exactly. I'm a songwriter. And also like when has like, if you're a rapper, you're a drummer, when has having another job ever negated the fact that you're a rapper or a drummer? Like, that's one thing I'm like, just because you do something else that isn't your passion, that doesn't mean that's what you, that's what, who you are. You know what I'm saying? We've all had to do stupid shit to get by. That doesn't mean you're a fucking McDonald's employee. You're still a rapper while you're working at McDonald's, bro. Be a rapper, own that shit. Like fucking be that shit.
Or own being a McDonald's employee. That's okay.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that either. But I'm saying, but you don't have to be like, I'm like, or like the whole idea of like a struggling rapper is like, bruh, you just a rapper. Like we're all struggling. Come on now.
Right. Yeah. Well, the world's most successful struggling rapper. How about that?
Exactly. Exactly.
That's my thing. Okay, cool. Well, this has been awesome. Is there anything else that you want to add or get off your chest or any words of wisdom for the kids at home?
Man, follow your dreams, do whatever you want to do and make cool shit. And I know you have a lot of people listening that, you know, aren't necessarily Lil Aaron fans or haven't heard of much, but I would encourage you all to listen to 808 Rock and actually give it a chance. I think it's a great project.
If you like Saliva and Kid Rock, you're gonna like 808 Rock.
There we go. And stay tuned. I'm working on a super dope album right now. I'm gonna try to not take 3 years on it, so fingers crossed. But yeah, thanks for having me on.
Right on.
Sounds good.
All right, let's get into some Q&A. From Jason Mandresh, how do you approach people for an interview? Well, it's very simple. You just need to send them a message on, you know, whatever platform that you choose to message them from. That could be Instagram, email, LinkedIn. You know, it's going to depend on the person. What I would do is, number one, find the platform where you think that they're most active and seem to be most engaged. So for example, some people you might see reply to a lot of people on Twitter, other people respond on Instagram, whatever. So find the platform where you think they're most likely to respond and then just send them a message and say, hey, how's it going? I'm a big fan of your work because blank. So the idea here is that you want people to know that you are a real, like that you appreciate their work, that this isn't just some copy and pasted thing. So then say, I would love to interview you on my podcast or for this magazine or whatever. And then a little bit of detail about the thing, in particular, like audience size. And if it's not a big audience, you know, that's maybe not ideal, but I wouldn't worry about that too much. Like for the most part, I think people do interviews because they think it's going to be a fun conversation, not so much because of the audience size. I mean, if you have a big audience, that definitely helps, but it's not required. But I would just be straightforward about that because, you know, you should be respectful of them. If your podcast gets 350 listens an episode, you know, you should be honest about that. Don't ever mislead people into thinking that it's bigger than it actually is. And then just say, like, you know, we could do it, and then give them a little bit of detail about how you want to do it. Like, oh, we could do it before your show on November 10th, or we can do it by Zoom. It won't take more than half an hour or something like that. And then, you know, let me know if you're interested. And then either they'll reply or they don't. And if they don't reply, follow up, you know, give them, I would say in general, a week or something like that, and follow up once and just say, hey, I don't know if you know, saw this or not, but I just wanted to follow up here to see if there's interest. If not, no worries. And don't worry about bothering them. If you follow up once, that's good. If you follow up more than that, that starts to get annoying. So really, that's all there is to it. You just want to have a very tight pitch. Like, don't just say, I want to interview you for my podcast, because I don't know what the podcast is about. I don't know how big it is. Like, I don't know enough to say yes. So give them all that information in the pitch. And, you know, sometimes people say yes, sometimes they say no. But if you just keep doing it, then eventually people will say yes. From Tyler Pike 406, do you ever feel like other professionals in the business world take your work less seriously because you make content for the scene, quote unquote? No, I have never encountered that, although sometimes I think they should, because if they knew how fucked up and dumb, you know, the music world is, then it probably should make them roll their eyes a little bit. But no, I've never encountered that. In fact, I would say it's the opposite. You know, music is one of those things that, you know, everybody thinks music is cool. So if you talk about music, there's going to be very, very few people other than me, because I'm an asshole. There's very few people that will see that as a negative. Like, and besides, with the audience size that I have now, like, it's big enough that it doesn't really matter what the content is about. Like, if I get 100,000 views on pretty much everything I put out within a week, and that's a big enough number that you kind of just have to respect it no matter what the content is. Like, if someone has a channel about model trains or classic football games or whatever it is that I don't care about, if they're getting 100,000 people a week to pay attention, like, you have to respect that. So I haven't had that problem. And in general, you know, I wouldn't worry about that. I think people will respect it if you are passionate about whatever it is that you're doing. And that's what it comes down to, as long as it's not like some super weird thing like brony stuff or hentai or something like that. As long as it's not any like actually kind of weird subject, nobody's going to care. They'll be excited that you are passionate about something. You know, passion is contagious. So I wouldn't worry too much about that if you are. All right, my friends, that does it for this episode of the podcast. If you made it this far, thank you. Thank you for listening. We sincerely appreciate each and every one of you. If you want to help the show, there's a couple things that you can do. First of all, share it on social media. If you share it, tag us, tag Finn McKenty, that's me, and tag Deanna Chapman, that's a producer. Second thing you can do, if you really, really, really love us and really want to support us, you can support us on Patreon. There's a link to that in the show notes. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening to this, or you can do none of that. And you can just sit at home, think about how awesome this podcast is. That works too. Again, thank you very much to each and every one of you for listening. We sincerely appreciate it, and we'll see you next time.
Hi, I'm Daniela Clark.
I'm Barbara Ann Wild.
And we are The Honest AF Show.
Our podcast is real, honest conversation with our celebrity friends and pros.
Covering our anything but average rock and roll lifestyles.
All while tackling the hell that is aging and the battle of beauty.
Oh yeah, nothing is off the table.
The Honest AF Show is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the corner of Gray Street.